This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that gets behind the headlines and to the real stories. We have as our guest this week, P. Gunasekaram, a consultant and independent business analyst. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Guna.
Thank you.
We also have on the line Dr. Michael Jayakumar. He's the Sungai Siput MP for Parti Socialist Malaysia. And we're going to be talking about the Malaysian Indian Blueprint. I want to begin with you, Guna. If you could just outline your argument for the Malaysian, or rather around the Malaysian Indian Blueprint. What's your take from this?
I've had a sort of like a cursory look at the Malaysian Indian Blueprint. It seems to be a pretty okay document, but I think you need something more than the document to actually sort of like progress the Indian in Malaysia. So, I mean, if you talk about who is the Malaysian Indian, that in itself is a question. But I think what we are doing is addressing the 75% of Indians who see their roots as in the plantations in Malaysia and building the roads and the railways and so on. So this is the group which is the really disadvantaged group, and this is the group that we are addressing towards, you know. And a little bit of history, when the workforce in the plantation sector was liberalized and you had a lot of foreign immigrant labor coming in, they displaced the workforce in the plantations, and as well as put paid to any kind of hope that there will be increase in incomes in the plantation sector. So you had a mass migration of these Indians to the urban areas, resulting in the proliferation of slums and so on. And eventually, more than 80% of Indians were living in the urban areas rather than when it was the opposite situation and in plantations before. You know? So that these are the people that we have to address. So...
Yeah, I want to just interrupt you at that point. Dr. Kumar, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I want to begin with your sense of the blueprint, which I understand is targeted actually at the bottom 40 of the community. What's your take on this blueprint?
I think it's a lot of hot air. I don't think it's going to do very much for the B40. Because though they keep saying B40 and the statistics are correct, but many of the programs, when they say you're going to increase intake into civil service by 7% at all levels, I'm going to be quite sure it's not going to come from the B40. They're going to come from the T20 and the M20, unless you have more directed targeting. And then you talk about you're going to have more Indian admissions to institutions of higher learning. So though you're talking about the B40 problems, when you just talk about Indians, higher number of Indians going to varsities, I can bet my bottom dollar it's not going to be proportionately distributed between the T20, M40, and the B40. You know, the B40 are still going to be left out. So it sounds very good. You know, you talk of all the problems of the B40. But then when you talk about these kinds of, programs where you just define it ethnically, the better off in the ethnic groups are going to benefit from this increased admission to universities, increased admissions to government jobs, the dollar-for-dollar support for investing in PNB and all that, is going to go to the higher income Indians and not to the B40. So he's talking one thing, but you don't seem to understand the socioeconomic, you know, diversity, and it's going to actually end up with the richer Indians.
Guna, I mean, what did you make of Dr. Kumar's criticisms? We do know, of course, that there's a whole range of programs under the blueprint. But do you think that, as he says, that when you define a problem in these terms, in ethnic terms, it's actually those who already have resources that are most likely to make the best of it?
Yeah, I think there is some of it in the blueprint to address these things. I think what one has to do is to start with education, which helps to uplift standards right across the board. So that is a major problem. But it's also to recognize the Indian's place in Malaysia. So that should be more widely recognized. So I say that beyond the blueprint, there should be also some amount of recognition given to the community and what it contributed to the country. You know, it made Malaysia the largest exporter of rubber. It improved infrastructure through the construction of roads and railways, for instance. And so this kind of recognition for the real contribution that this the Indian community made to the nation must be recognized, and there must be respect given to them. You know, I mean, for their way of life without being harassed, you know, without temples being demolished and broken and so on and so forth. And finally, some kind of a just reward for this. I'm not talking about an NEP for Indians as such, but no hindrance towards the progress of Indians by sometimes overzealous civil administrators and so on. So it needs a change in mindset within government, within and outside our government, towards Indians as a whole.
Dr. Kumar, what do you make of this comment by Gunnar? Do you think the document really is a feel-good document that suggests that the government recognizes the contributions of the Indian community? And if it's so, what is the value of this kind of recognition?
Well, I think the fact they are talking about it, that is good. You know, but I think it can be improved quite easily. You know, I mean, basically, you got to have some degree of socioeconomic targeting. And one way you can target that is to look at housing. If you go to the urban areas, you know, and look at the people who are still living in squatter slums, who are still renting homes from people who were ground tenants, like in Sungai Siput, that many kampungs around Sungai Siput town, where the original ground tenants have got better, they bought houses in Tamans, and they've gone there. And their old houses, which are ground tenant houses, where they, you know, just pay ground rent, but the house owns to these guys, is now rented to poorer people coming in from the estates. Now, if you focus on these people and talk about, you know, housing for them, for example, if you try and give them subsidized housing, and don't talk about affordable housing being $200,000, that doesn't make sense for people earning less than $3,000 a month. You know, talking about houses worth more than 100,000 is just not possible. So that's not affordable. So yes, we have problems with our definitions of what is affordable. But I think, you know, things like that, there's still 16,000 Indian families on the estates. Pass a law saying all estates should, within 5 years, start a housing scheme for estate workers who've been there for more than 10 years, failing which the government will take a certain portion of their estate land and build a scheme themselves. Something like that. So if you do that, that's more targeted. That's targeted at the people who are actually in the B40 and maybe in the bottom of the B40. You know, that kind of targeting, socioeconomic targeting, is crucial. If you don't target it that way and talk generally in terms of Indians as a whole, then, like I said earlier, it's going to, more of the benefits will accrue to the people who are in a position to understand what's going on, go out and get it, you know, and have the facilities and the economic, you know, things to get it.
Now, the question that there has been proposals for a Social Inclusion Act, would something like that in terms of legislation be much more useful than an ethnically defined blueprint?
So, I mean, if you were to define your target groups on socioeconomic terms, I think that will be much, much easier, you know, to make sure the aid goes to the people who really need it. See, the another group, because I have a lot of contact with poor people in my constituency. Another group at the bottom of the barrel are the single mothers. Single because the husbands have left them, or they've died, or they're in prison, or drug rehabilitation, or just plain useless, so they're around, you know. Now, these mothers are really in a bad shape. So for them, subsidized housing, for example, vouchers for childcare, for example, you know, vouchers for transport. These are things that, again, targeted, you know, but it really will help a really down and out and marginalized group who are really struggling, because these mothers, I mean, don't have very high education. They go and work. They're competing with the illegal Bangladeshi and Nepali workers, and they get less than the minimum wage. And they got no child care. You know, if they have their own mother around or older sister, then it's okay, but many of them on their own. So the kids are just left without any supervision when they come back from school, you know. So the whole cycle, intergenerational transmission of poverty, just continues.
Now, Gunnar, I want to ask you, when coming back to this question of the Indian blueprint, which is not just about the Indian poor, it also must be about the Indian middle classes. It must also be about the vanguard of the Indian community, say, from a business point of view. Shouldn't they also be targeted in a blueprint that is about the Indian community as a whole?
I'm not sure whether you want to spend much effort in actually helping people who are already pretty well off, because one has to recognize that a section of the Indian community is actually very affluent and very well off. But this 75% that I'm talking about, a lot of them are not. So I think the MIB is right when it targets the bottom 40%. Then by targeting the bottom 40%, then they will be reaching this group which has been ignored. You know, and the thing is, I suspect that if actual statistics are properly available, then it will indicate that this group has actually been slipping relative to the performance to other ethnic groups in the country. You know, because I mean, just look at some of the social indicators which are given in the MIB, and 21% of domestic violence cases Indians. You know, so it's three times their population share. 70% of gang members Indians. You know, that is 10 times. You know. And 31% of violent crimes involves Indians, four times their figure. So these are really terribly frightening figures, and is symptomatic of a community which is actually crying out for some help from the broader social group, you know, which actually targets them. So that actually, I mean, the Indian blueprint might go some way towards helping this, but it needs actually a major change in the thinking of the people who administer, who minister to these people. So they have to recognize that the Indians have a place in the country, and you should give them that the voice and the right to be part of the community instead of being, continue to be marginalized.
Thank you very much. We were speaking to Dr. Michael Jayakumar, Sungai Siput MP, Member of Parliament for Parti Socialist Malaysia. We'll be back, Guna, after this, BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Shirai Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, and our guest, P. Gunasegaram. He's a consultant and independent business analyst. I want to talk very quickly about inflation. Inflation numbers came out last week. Guna, what is your take on the numbers?
They seem to be rather high, you know. I mean, it's 8-year high, you know, of 5.1% in March. It's not just fuel, but prices of other things are also up, especially food and non-alcoholic beverages, and they have been up 4.1%. And this is an important group because I think they comprise something like about 30% of the basket, which comprises which measures inflation. So this is also higher than other countries, such as India, 3.8%, Indonesia 3.6%, Philippines 3.4%, China 0.9%, Thailand 0.8%, Singapore 0.7%, Hong Kong 0.5%. So we seem to be among the highest in terms of inflation. And then to find the answer, I don't think we have to go very far. Part of it is because of the declining ringgit. That forms a huge part. So you have a huge component of imported inflation. And also, as a result of this, the exporters can get higher prices for goods that they would ordinarily sell to Malaysians. You know? So they have a tendency to export goods rather than sell it to Malaysians, you know? It's because they will get their price in overseas currencies.
But it appears that the higher than average inflation has seemed to have abated because, yeah, you rightly pointed out, March inflation came in at 5.1%. But we look at April's figures, though, that came in on the 17th, yeah, last week. It came in at 4.4%. So it seems to be coming off a little bit. Also, when you look at the ringgit, I'm looking at the ringgit right now, it's actually back down to its strongest since November of last year. Now it's below 4 ringgit and 31 cents to the dollar. And you recall not too long ago, it's at 4 ringgit 45 cents almost, right? Yeah, so, you know, but perhaps, I mean...
What was it a year ago, the ringgit?
Well, a year ago, let me just find out real quick while you're doing that, man.
I think, you see, the thing is, the ringgit has not been at this level for a very, very long period of time. I mean, it's even if it's 4.3, I wouldn't consider it a fair rate for the ringgit, you know, considering the overall position of the economy and so on. But the thing is, if you go back in time, in 2009, the ringgit it was 3 ringgit to the US dollar. It's now what, 4.3? Yeah. So it's a huge depreciation over the over the period.
Yeah.
So and if you compare with the one year ago period, the ringgit is actually a lot lower.
That's right. Yeah. So the ringgit is a year ago it was just below 4.1 to the US dollar. Right now it's about 4.3 against the US dollar.
Okay, so we can sort of suggest what is the cause of the inflation, the high inflation rates. But is there there anybody to blame? I mean, can, in fact, government, if we want to blame somebody, we often look at government. If we can blame anybody, I mean, is this something the government in some ways blameless about?
Yes, in the short term, the value of the ringgit is very much dictated by sentiment. You know, and as you know, we have had a lot of issues in terms of 1 MDB and so on. And tens of billions of ringgit of money cannot be accounted for. Total of money that cannot be accounted for may be as high as 40 billion eventually, you know, 40 billion ringgit. That's a lot of money. So, but the economy is such that it can still absorb this. I'm not condoning it by any means, but I'm saying that the strength of the economy is such that it can absorb it. Mm. But the question on investors' minds is how much more is you know, how much worse can it get, and what else can happen in this case? So there is a sort of a risk premium, you know, now on the ringgit. So which is why it becomes, you know, less valuable as a result.
Right, but you've got comments like, say, in the Edge Daily today that the ringgit appears to have turned a corner, at least in the short term. You know, so, and I'm also wondering if is it too far of a stretch to say to link 1 MDB and inflation? Because I can see how, you know, 1 MDB to the ringgit and the ringgit to inflation,
yes,
maybe.
Yes.
Yeah, is that what you are thinking?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not directly. It is because of the value of the ringgit, you know.
Right.
So, and then, you know, also although the point has been made that our economy is a lot less dependent on oil than it used to be, and that's true, that when the oil price starts going up, the common perception is that we are going to have a balance of payments problems. So because, it's the other way around. When the oil price starts going down, you have a balance of payments problem because we're a net oil exporter, you know, or net energy exporter would be more accurate. So that adds to the negativity on the ringgit. So again, the oil price has now been creeping up slowly, and so that is considered to be positive for the ringgit.
So in terms of, you know, say trying to stem this, you know, higher than average inflation, and again, this is not something that's unique to Malaysia. We have had comments from central banks of developed economies, right? The Bank of England, Bank of Japan, even the Fed talking about how they are willing to tolerate this kind of high inflation, and that's mainly due to the energy prices. But, you know, Gunnar, in terms of what kind of, in terms of the policies, right? What kind of policies, you know, do you think can be implemented to try and stem that rising inflation?
I think you should give a message, for instance, that you will, in the long term, go for policies which strengthen the ringgit. So that's important. I mean, if you go back to the 70s, the Singapore dollar and the Malaysian ringgit were exchangeable on par. Now that's over $3 now for one Sing dollar. You know? So other things, if you cut corruption and reduce procurement costs and cut leakage, that will bring down costs down as well. You know, and then cutting import taxes and excise duties, especially on cars. You know, here you are, you have removed the subsidies. Then, but why aren't you not cutting the taxes at the same time? You know? So if you cut these taxes, the cost of usage of things for the general public comes down. And then we have all the laws in terms of anti-profiteering and price control mechanisms. So enforce these things. So that would be important. And then encourage competition. So make sure that, you know, I mean, not one importer imports all the oranges from China, for instance. You know, that used to happen at one time. So when you sort of, you know, liberalize your licensing requirements and encourage competition, that helps to bring down inflation as well.
You know, that'll be the theory, though, with a little time that we have left. But we saw recently how the government set that ceiling price for Raw 95, right? Allowing retailers to perhaps, you know, cut prices, you know, in order to be more competitive. But we did, apparently, according to what analysts told me, not one single retailer has actually written to the government saying, hey, we would like to offer Raw 95 at lower prices. So do you think that, you know, this kind of competitive policies that foster competition, does that really work in a Malaysian context?
It may not work for oil because, I mean, oil is a very, you know, very large kind of like a commodity, and then people tend to just stick around that. But it would work for other things, you know, your imports and things like that. If more people get import licenses, then there will be some kind of more efficient pricing as far as that is concerned, you know, more restaurants around, more stalls, those kind of things.
I understand you also advocate restaurants serving filtered water for free. Now, that's something I think we could all, you know, back.
And real quick, update here, Singapore dollar to the ringgit, 3.1. No more on par. That was decades ago now.
Well, thank you so much, Gunnar, for joining us this morning. So that was P. Gunasegaram, consultant and independent business analyst. Tan Chung Han and myself, Shoa Kutin, coming up is the news, and after that, Enterprise. You've been listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.